And welcome back to How to Survive 2025, Episode 3. I'm Brian Keene.
I am Jim Cobb.
And Dacia Arnold is on mute. Unmute yourself, Dacia.
There we go. All right. There we go. I'm Dacia M. Arnold.
And for our audio listening audience, we should apologize. This is our first time actually recording live on video as well as audio. Our YouTube viewers will be able to see us as we talk about the end of the world. And they'll be able to see Dacia's blooper. It's like a blooper reel. But we can see it. Oh my
goodness. I don't have like an inside face. Like
that's okay. I don't have an inside voice, so we're a good match. And Jim doesn't have inside or outside hair. So
No. The thing I have to remember is to not make those expressions on my face out loud.
There you go.
On video now.
There you go.
It's a struggle. It's a real struggle.
Yeah.
It is. So today is part two of our two-parter on mindset. And as we warned listeners last week when we gave them that homework assignment, and we're going to warn you again here at the top of the show, we are actually discussing before we began recording, are we rated PG-13 or R? And we decided we're probably a soft R, given to the amount of cursing that both Dacia and myself do, mostly Dacia. But we are going to be talking about some things like PTSD and trauma and grief. Mm-hmm. So if you have, you know, kids in the house under the age of 13, let's say, or, you know, maybe older, but you know what their sensitivities are, you may want to consider that before you're listening to this episode. Before we get into that though, Jim, I know you had, last week we talked about doom scrolling and falling into the trap of doom scrolling. And you had some thoughts on that. You said something that, that really stuck with me throughout the week. You said you should be prepping to live, but not living to prep. It should be part of your life, but it shouldn't run your life. It should reduce fear, not increase it. I thought that was beautiful, and I wanted to spotlight it right here at the beginning. And I thought maybe we should talk a little bit more about doom scrolling and how not to fall into that trap.
Well, and it's a common thing that happens, particularly when you're new to preparedness and you're becoming more conscious of risks around you, whether it's local or national or international. The problem comes in when you become hyper aware of these different risks and different risk factors, and you get to the point where you don't want to leave your house. You don't want to go out to the movies because, gosh, there was a mass shooting a few years ago at a movie theater. You don't want to run the risk of that happening to you. Or you don't want to go to the grocery store because somebody might abduct you or your child because you're hearing about all these, this human trafficking in the news, things like that. Now, let me say this. In 2020, I discovered fairly early on that my preferred lifestyle is called quarantine. I was still kind of sort of new to working from home at that point, and I was perfectly happy to not go anywhere and not do anything for days on end and just stay at home. But that wasn't out of fear. You know, that was just, I kind of like not being around a lot of people all the time. Don't get to the point in your life where you're afraid to engage in social activities because of what might happen. Okay. Don't hinge your life on what if. A far better approach is to use prepping, use preparedness to give yourself a level of confidence that you're going to be okay if the remote chance something does happen outside the home, in your home, whatever the case is. Prepping should give you confidence, but by the same token, don't get cocky. Okay. I've met a fair number of preppers and survivalists over the years who have gone way to the other extreme, thinking that, you know, they're 10 feet tall and invulnerable because they have years of experience and training and every gadget known to man. And the thing is, the fates don't like that. And cockiness and arrogance can get you killed. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to be aware of your surroundings, but you don't need to be Jason Bourne. Okay. And basically the gist of all of this is being better prepared should augment your life. It shouldn't narrow your life. If that makes any kind of sense.
It makes absolute sense. I have a background in the military, and when I go out in public, I try not to be hyper aware. I try not to count how many people are in the grocery store. But for a long time, like, I would not even consider getting a concealed carry license, even though, like, if anyone knew how to use a handgun responsibly, like, it would be me. But I knew that if I had my children with me and I was carrying, that my hypervigilance is something I could not turn off. I would not be able to be present with my children and get the task done that I needed to do without also being on. And I say being on, that's that hypervigilance, that something feels wrong and I'm going to have to respond immediately. I had a good friend, my son was in kindergarten and her daughter was in kindergarten, and her husband were police officers in the area. I worked all the time. I was never able to make it to my son's events. So while she stayed in the back, I knew exactly what she was doing. I knew she had an eye on every exit. I knew that she was making sure she knew the parents and who was supposed to be there, who wasn't supposed to be there. But I had to put that away and I had to sit in the front. So my little boy would see that, you know, his mom finally made it to something. But it's one of those moments that it kind of put that hypervigilance into perspective.
Mm-hmm. You know, as you're talking about it, I envy you that you are able to turn it off. It's something I've never been able to do. I suspect mine actually doesn't come from the military. It comes from childhood and some of the stuff I went through as a kid. But even today, both my sons and now my stepdaughter, they're used to, if we go to the movies, to use Jim's example, you know, it's become a game where they can quiz me, where are the fire exits? And I can tell them exactly where they are. You know, I track anybody I think looks shifty. Rarely has that person ever actually turned out to be a threat or shifty, but I track them anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, if my youngest is in marching band, high school marching band, and, you know, when we're at a parade, I'm trying to enjoy the performance and the floats as they go by, but I catch myself watching the crowd. It's like breathing. I forget I'm doing it. Sometimes I am aware that I'm being ridiculous. A great example, Donald Trump, presidential candidate Donald Trump, was here in our hometown speaking yesterday. So the roads were shut down and, you know, there was a security cordon like you wouldn't believe. And I had to go out for business and I knew which roads to take to get around, you know, all the security stuff. But then, like, every piece of roadkill or litter along the side of the road, I'm like, is that an IED? You know? And then I'm like, okay, you're being ridiculous right now.
I think
So yeah, I envy you being able to turn it off. I'm constantly doing it. I'm usually not aware that I'm doing it.
I'm not aware when I put it away. I know it comes up every single time. I know it's always like, bam, and then I'm able to put it away. You brought up roadkill and IEDs. And one of my biggest fears is war following me home. And it's been my biggest fear. I have nightmares where I'm going through in processing in the military and I haven't run 2 miles I have recently, but I haven't run 2 miles in a long time. I mean, that's not part of the post-traumatic stress, but the fact that, like, I did my time, I'm done, I left it there, and it needs to stay there. It doesn't need to happen at the airfield down the street from where I live. It is very stressful. And feeling like I was almost like at ground zero of another civil war over somebody getting assassinated is not fun for me.
Right. Elaborate, because our listeners might not be aware. You live near.
So I actually live in Butler, Pennsylvania, where the attempted assassination on former President Donald Trump took place. We drive past it. We actually drove past it the day after, and there was media everywhere. The flag was still flying, but it was on our way up to go to Lake Erie to spend time with our family because it's so precious.
Right. Yeah. So, you talk about the war following you home. I always think about my father and one of his best friends, and I'm not going to give his friend's name on the air because he's a private citizen, but they were both 82nd Airborne during Vietnam. Some of the best of the best. Mm-hmm. My old man made it to sergeant. They were both still on active duty when they came home, and they got put on riot control. They were in Detroit, they were in Washington, D.C., and they were in Chicago. And they were carrying that war with them, and it was still very, very fresh for both of them. Now they're on American soil with their fellow citizens, and both of them have spoke over the years. They think that messed them up worse than the war ever did, particularly for his friend. His friend was Black, and on the front lines of the riots, he would get called an Uncle Tom, like, constantly, and betraying his people. And I know that really messed him up. And my dad was a very different person when I was a kid. To his credit, my dad was a blue collar West Virginia hillbilly. He didn't know about things like PTSD, and I doubt Veterans Affairs ever told him about PTSD. But to his credit, he realized there was something going on with him. I remember being maybe 5 or 6 years old. I'm on the swing set, my dad's mowing the lawn, and some choppers come overhead, and he stopped, he let go of the push mower, he ducked, he stared, and I recognize, first it's dad's playing army. And then I got a little older. I'm like, no, that's not what he's doing. I would notice when I was like 14, 15 and we're out deer hunting. He wasn't deer hunting like some of the other dads. He was back in the bush. But in really thinking about it, where I really saw it prevalent was anytime we were in public in a crowd. And I think he was going back to the riots in his mind. And to his credit, he did eventually get help and work his way through that, which was not something men of his generation did. It's not even something that men of our generation have necessarily been taught to do. I've gone through it myself. Listeners to our show may occasionally hear me reference The Sopranos as being my favorite show, and it is. And the reason it's my favorite show is because I approached therapy with the same trepidation and sarcasm that Tony Soprano approaches it. And much like the character, I did find it beneficial in the end. The war following you home, that's a big one, Deja. Wow.
It is. That's why I write fiction. Fiction is safe. It is a safe place for me to process kind of the things that I went through. I feel like I did a good job of filing it away, but there's no organization to the filing away. It's just put away. So I don't have to look at it every day. And it'll sneak up on me at the beginning of 2020. I was asked to help write a pilot episode of a MASH reboot. And yeah, and it was they're not MASHes anymore. They're combat support hospitals. We call them CASHes. So this was going to be CASH. When I was deployed to Baghdad Emergency Room, our head doctor wrote a book, Baghdad ER, the first 15 minutes, because in a normal emergency room, you have like the first 30 minutes or 45 minutes, the golden hour to get people packaged up and sent up to the operating room. So in Baghdad, we had 15 minutes. That is how long these kids had. And I call them kids because we were all kids, to get them packaged up, sent upstairs. I hadn't read this book. It had been at least a decade. So I crack it open to study for writing this pilot. And I found out, I shared last week, that the doctors had collectively decided that they would never lose their shit in the ER. They would never freak out. They would never yell. We didn't yell in the emergency room. This is the second busiest trauma hospital at the time. And we did not yell in the emergency room. But because they didn't freak out, because they didn't yell at us and belittle us in the middle of a trauma, I was able to get through it. I was able to file it away like that happened and there's no other way it would have happened. And we move on because I've got another mass casualty coming through the door. And so I was able to read the beginning of that book in preparation to write this pilot. But then there was another show going on at the same time called 68 Whiskey. And it was kind of the same mentality of like a Today MASH. And there, in the first episode, there was this flight medic who made a mistake. It was a big mistake. And it brought me back to a mistake that I made, that I was like, someone reassured me, hey, like it wouldn't have happened any other way, but it triggered me so bad. And it brought back that feeling of, I made a mistake and I can't make a mistake because of who we have here and who is losing because of that mistake. So then I wasn't able to do the pilot. I wasn't able to help him write the pilot. COVID happened anyway, and we weren't able to get together to work on the pilot. But then I incorporated zombies into the story, and I was able to get through it. I was able to process kind of all that mess that happened.
That's a healthy way to process it. It's better than drugs or booze or, you know. I know too many guys that turn to that. I just realized I forgot to mute my phone. I'm sorry, folks. I know it's funny that writing was sort of your coping mechanism. I do the same thing. We talked last week about the time I caught on fire, the time I did my best Richard Pryor imitation. Younger listeners won't understand that reference. It was, you know, when I got out of the burn ward, I thought I was fine. You know, I really did. I'm like, yeah, fine. I've lived through worse, and I have lived through worse, although that one came close. Until the first time Mary and I were watching something where, I don't even remember what movie or show it was, but a character caught on fire. And I had to leave the room and go out in the front yard and throw up. Then it occurred to me, okay, well, dummy, you're not fine. So we're going to have to deal with this. And that time it wasn't therapy, and it also wasn't booze or drugs. It was, I ended up writing about it. I was a showrunner on season 3 of Silverwood. And in the season finale, there's a character who catches on fire. And I put it all into that scene, and fucked up other people instead of myself.
I mean, trauma can happen in ways that aren't so big also. I experienced losing my first puppy recently, and it affected me, knowing my background, like it affected me in a way that I did not anticipate. We moved to a new place near a busy road, and our grumpy old man decided that he was going to go hiking in the woods. His fence collar had died or wasn't turned on, and he'd even come back to the yard. So he doesn't come back all day. It starts snowing. It's the first snow of the year. And then I go on the neighborhood page and someone had posted that there was very specifically my breed of dog they saw get hit. Aww. And I felt horrible for this. She witnessed it. I felt horrible, but broke my husband. Absolutely broke him. I'm okay. I go tell the kids, hey, we're going to go get our pup, you know, just hang out for a minute. He was right up the road. So I'm like, you guys stay in bed. It's late. You guys stay in bed. We'll be right back. So I drove. We went, got him in the truck, brought him home. I mean, it's snowing actively outside. And then once like we were home and we were parked, I'm like, we're not digging in the dark. He's not going anywhere. He's going to be fine. Like he can stay here for the night in the truck. We need to go talk to the kids. And then we went to tell the kids. And then so that's when I finally broke down so I could show my children that yes, sad feelings are still healthy feelings. You can still feel sadness. But for a long time, I feared that my whole family would perish because of something that I could not stop. And it was my dog. Dogs are family. God, that he was our first child. And it hurt really bad, but it affected me in a way that was kind of disconnected from the actual event.
Now,
go ahead, Jim.
Let me jump in here just for a second. While we're talking about these different experiences, what are some, well, at some point, I'd like us to get to where we're sharing some coping mechanisms, mm-hmm. showing things that our listeners can take away from this, what you found works to get you through, you know, reminiscing about a traumatic event, where you're just kind of frozen for a little bit. What tools have you developed that help you get through that?
I mean, for PTSD, it's threefold. One, as I said earlier, talk therapy did help me. You know, I won't make fun of it. I think it has value. You know, I'm still not a new agey guy. I'm not going to hold hands with the world and sing Kumbaya, but I believe talk therapy works. Putting it into my art, channeling it into my art worked. You know, if there's a listener out there who doesn't think they're artistic or creative, you know, maybe there's something else you're good at. Plumbing can be art, you know. But
see what I've got cobbled together underneath my kitchen sink.
You know, the other thing, and as I said, I went through a lot in childhood, and we're not going to recount it here on the show because first of all, it'd be a 2-hour episode. Second of all, I just don't want to talk about it. If listeners are curious, and I'm not saying this to plug it, I'm just saying it because it exists. I wrote a novel called Ghoul. The main character, Timmy, is 99.9% autobiographical. That'll give you an idea of what I went through as a kid. What I have found is what I impress upon my three children, and that is a parent's job is to be better than the parents that came before. If you had terrible parents, it's an easy job. If you had great parents, it's a hard job, but that's your job. But as far as grief, you know, with what Deja was just talking about, I'm not the one to ask. I am unlucky enough to have lost an obscene amount of friends my age over the last decade. I think the tally is up to 18 now. Almost all of them from cancer or some other illness, two from violence, but the rest from cancer or an illness. I've tried different coping mechanisms. Some of them, like breaking up with my girlfriend and redeveloping a taste for cocaine, were not useful at all. Some of them, like talk therapy in this specific case, really didn't help me. I find the only thing that has helped is the passage of time. And I hate to say that to listeners because they're looking for firm, hard, simple answers. And that's none of those things. But yeah, it's just the passage of time has made the pain and the loss manageable. I think that the toughest thing is having the discipline to be patient and allow that passage of time to happen.
I think one of the things that helped me the most is
oh, I should have grabbed tissues.
Was forgiving myself for any passing of someone close to me. I didn't kill. I've never murdered anybody. But you take on so much guilt and so much blame. Just like, oh, I should have called more. I should have said this. I should have said that. Maybe it would have changed something. It's not always the case. And then stop blaming and stop being so mad. Being angry will eat your soul until there's nothing left. I should have grabbed tissues. I'm doing okay, though. I'm doing all right.
You know, I got a Navy buddy. I won't identify him on the air other than to say his last name's Bloom. You know, he and I were super tight. And Daisha, you hit it. We were kids when we served. And our wives like to say now that when we get together, you know, we're both in our early 50s, and when we get together, we immediately revert to being kids again. But we had a string of deaths of guys we served with. And it was all, they were all from cancer, every one of them. And Bloom convinced himself it was the burn bags. We would take top secret material, we'd put them in bags, we'd incinerate them out in the middle of the ocean. He said, it's like Desert Storm with those burn pits. And I would say, well, those are really different than what we were burning. But he swore up and down that this is why everybody had caught cancer and it was going to happen to us too. And I realized about the third time he brought it up, this is his way of coping. He blames himself. Mm-hmm. He feels guilty for still being here and they're gone. He misses them. He's worried he's going to be next. I identify with all these things too. This is his way of coping, you know. And I don't know that way is necessarily destructive. And I guess that's the thing. Nobody can tell you what your coping mechanism is. Just try to make it something that's not destructive to yourself or, more importantly, to those around you.
And that's important. You know, Daisha, you talked about the anger part of it. And that's something that really resonates with me. I've lost both my parents. My mom, we lost about 15 years ago. She was in her mid-50s. Oh, wow. And my dad was back in 2019. And with my dad in particular, it was about 2 years of utter hell with him, with his declining health. And we were dealing with, he had a part-time caregiver that we found out was robbing him blind. And, you know, we had a lot going on that was quite literally dumped into my lap. You know, people talk about how horrible 2020 was to go through with everything that happened. I'm telling you right now, 2020 was a fucking cakewalk compared to what I went through in 2018 and 2019. I was skipping through 2020 after everything I dealt with. And partially because of having to deal with those things, and partially because of things that my father would say whether it was under the influence of medication or not, I was very angry. I was very bitter. There are probably a handful of listeners out there by now who know me personally and who have known me for years. And when I say that I have never been more angry, more furious than I was during that period of time, that's saying something, because there are an awful lot of people who didn't think I'd make it to 25.
Wow.
Okay. And I still, to this day, I get that it bubbles up every now and again. But one of the things that I, like Brian said, time heals, time helps. And like Dacia said, the forgiving yourself, you know, and part of it for me was to give myself permission to say, it's okay. It's done. It's over. You need to move on. You know, there are certain things that, you know, if I hear a certain phrase in a movie, it takes me right back to sitting in my dad's living room and listening to him rant about whatever. But for the most part, I've moved on. We still have two garages full of his shit that we need to dispose of at some point. But the important thing, I think one of the big takeaways here, when we're dealing with trauma and we're dealing with grief, and even to a degree with PTSD, is you need to give yourself permission to say, I'm okay. You need to give yourself permission to be happy. You know, I think sometimes we get so wrapped up in trauma and grief and everything that, to a large part, that becomes our identity to ourselves. That's just who we are. We're this bitter, pissed off person who can't stand the world because of these bad things that happened. And at some point, you need to kind of shed that skin a little bit and say, okay, that really sucked. But I have this spouse, I have these kids, I have this career, I have these other wonderful things that I'm not enjoying, because I'm focused too much on what happened in the past, on these bad issues, these bad circumstances. And like we said, kind of at the top of the show, you need to live your life. And part of that comes from, it's okay. That happened, but I'm not going to be that person anymore.
Right.
I think in your own time too.
Well, yeah,
there definitely is no time frame on grief, no, or being angry or being mad or feel robbed. There is no timeline on honoring them with your mourning. There is no timeline.
Nope. And if it's kind of ironic you bring that up, that timeline thing. My in-laws, my wife's parents, just lost their dog recently. They had to put the dog down, variety of health issues, and within a couple of days, they're talking about getting a new dog. And my wife and I were chatting about it, and I think her parents are concerned that other people are going to look at them and say, well, how soon? I mean, that's pretty fast. That's a quick turnaround. And we both kind of at the same time kind of said, there's no accepted time frame when it comes to grief. Mm-mm. It's what works best for you. Now, me, I was encouraging from day one. I mean, you need to get a new dog. You know, you need to replace that hole. They're both older. It's a very quiet home without that dog. You know, and they've both remarked on that about how quiet it is. Get a new dog. Nobody is going to fault you for wanting another companion, you know. And it's important to understand that everybody's situation is different, whether we're talking about grief or we're talking about food storage for a disaster. Everybody's situation is different. Uh-huh. And as we go through this show and as we start branching into these other topics, it's important that listeners and viewers now understand we're not giving you a checklist. We're not saying do this, do this, do this, do this. We're going to give you guidelines, and we're going to explain to you things that you should keep in mind, things that you should consider, but then tailor everything to meet your specific situation.
You know, that's a great segue. We should probably let listeners know what we are going to talk about next week. And that is, in fact, food storage. Coming up, we'll also be talking, of course, about water storage, because that goes hand in hand with food storage, yep. Home security, eventually bug out bags, although we aren't going to talk about them right away. Jim, you want to explain why? Because I know we'll get some listeners asking why.
Well, my philosophy has always been, when it comes to a disaster, shelter in place at home until or unless home is no longer safe. It makes your life easier if you are able to shelter in place at home. You don't have to carry anything anywhere. That's where all your stuff is. That's where you're likely to be most comfortable. That said, it is important to have a plan for if home isn't safe, mm-hmm. where you're going to go, what you're going to take with you, things like that. And we will get into that at some point. But bugging out, to use the preferred prepper phrase, bugging out should never be your primary plan, except in very rare circumstances or very individual circumstances. If you live in an area that is prone to wildfire, then yeah, bugging out is probably going to be one of your primary plans. You live in the Midwest, you live, you know, suburban area that's not prone to wildfires, hurricanes, things like that, odds are hunkering down at home is going to be your best bet. And that's why we want to approach that first. We will get to the bug out stuff later. It's fun stuff to talk about, but let's walk before we run, so to speak.
Well, here's a fun fact for our listeners, is that I have not prepped. Not to say I am not a prepper. And the reason is because it triggers me. Because I spiral when I think about things such as that, just like not carrying a concealed carry, not, you know, carrying a weapon out in public. Even reading books. So I didn't read The Unthinkable by Amanda Ripley that you suggested. And normally mm-hmm. I read everything, but I was reading, don't laugh, The Wheel of Time, the last book in this 14 book series, ends in this epic continent wide war against good and evil. And there are pregnant women fighting, and there are women fighting and men fighting. And it was intense. And then someone almost got assassinated. And I was like, oh my God, I need to step away. But even nonfiction, I read Raven Rock is a book about the nation's history and nuclear response. That worked me up. It was very interesting. It was great information, totally ruined me for a long time. My coping mechanism, just by default, is planning. It mm-hmm. is planning, but it is planning to an extreme where I become completely obsessed with, this is how many gallons of water that each person needs per day. We need that times this many months for each of us. And then we need food. And this is how many cans of green beans we eat in a year. So I'm going to buy this many pounds. I'm going to boil it, can it, get it, everything. I know what to do. I have all the books. I have everything that I might need to prep when I'm able to prep. But just like some of our listeners who just don't know where to start, this is really helping me talk about it, normalize it, help me to feel like, no, I'm not a crazy person. I'm not taking a deep dive.
Well, you're not any crazier than the rest of us.
You bring up an interesting point, Aisha. Jim, you teach a lot of seminars and workshops.
Yep.
Things like that on this stuff. Do you ever get people, students, maybe they acknowledge it, maybe it's subconscious and they're unaware of it, who are very clearly dealing with anxiety or grief or PTSD or something, and this becomes an outlet for them. This becomes a coping mechanism, a way to heal.
I've run into a lot of people who came out of COVID, came out of 2020 with the mindset of, I'm never going to be in that position again. I'm never going to be in a position where I need things that I can't get. And I've met a few people who, you know, talking with them privately and them sharing photos of their preps and that, they have gone way to an extreme to the point where they probably would be called hoarders. Yeah. And that's actually, we run into that in the prepper world on a fairly regular basis, where you have non-preppers who just consider preppers to be hoarders because they have this in their mind that all we do is accumulate massive quantities of stuff that we squirrel away in every nook and cranny of our home. And that's not really what prepping is. There's a phrase that is common in the prepper world: skills trump stuff. Meaning knowing how to do things is more important than just accumulating stuff. And that's absolutely 100% correct. The corollary to that, though, is it doesn't need to be a competition. Skills trump stuff, but skills plus stuff is even better. Knowing how to preserve your food, for example, while at the same time investing in extra food and supplies, is that's a winning combination. You know, and again, we'll get into the food stuff next week, and we'll talk about what's realistic and what you don't really need. And again, how to tailor all of this to your circumstance, to your family situation, so that you're not a hoarder and you're not, you know, just setting aside years and years worth of food that's just going to go bad eventually. But at the same time, should you be faced with a crisis, you'll have what you need to make it through and keep your family fed, hydrated, and safe.
Can I give out the homework assignment this week?
Sure.
Yep. Yes. So at work, we often talk about early detection of early onset dementia and what we would do with the knowledge that we are highly susceptible to developing dementia and how that might affect our family. And if we knew about it ahead of time, what would we do to prepare? So with this in mind, my homework for everyone, if you don't already have one, go work on your wills. Work on your wills, work on your powers of attorney, work on your living will. Communicate to your family.
Yep.
What you want to happen in the case that you are still here, but you're not all there. Mm-hmm. Or in the case that you're not here at all. You're going to save your children a lot of heartache, a lot of therapy, a lot of fucking pissed offness if you do this. And it's, you know, for me, it's like one of the least, you know, it's the least I could do to prepare my kids for when they're adults.
Yeah. Yeah. That is very, very important.
Great homework assignment, Daisha. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Well, I guess that brings us to the end of this episode. Food storage next week, which reminds me, I need to, when we get done here, I need to go down to the garden and pick 1,000 more tomatoes and get them ready for canning. So, all right. Any final thoughts? Anything you guys want to plug before we sign off?
We have a Facebook page. We have an Instagram page. We have a Twitter page, How to Survive 2025. You can look up the hashtag. You'll find us. And that's about it.
Yeah, and we're everywhere now. Hello, Spotify. Hello, Apple. Hello, iHeartRadio. I'm watching the listing numbers tick up over the last 2 weeks. We seem to be striking a chord. And happy to announce that starting with today's episode, we will have transcripts available for those who are so inclined to use those. Lots of good stuff happening. We're prepared All right, we will see you next week, folks.
All right, goodbye.